перед нами выбор. Нарушать эти правила или не нарушать?
Фрейс. Я его спрашиваю.
What?
Тебе нравится наш город?
You're gonna sit up in the audience. Okay.
Он отвечает. Тут неплохо. Мы были...
Yeah.
So I guess I'm wondering how those three
Well, the title's definitely a work in progress. It keeps changing. It's long and cantankerous right now, and I have mixed feelings about it. Certain other people, Jeff, the main actor in the piece, really is pretty committed to us at least keeping the white on white part. And the piece was inspired by. Very initially by sort of looking at the concepts of Malevich and suprematism and the idea of things, these extreme ideas about transcendence and about looking for nothingness and empty space and how that manifests in architecture and idea and sort of ideas of everyday life. And so we went to these places where there was a lot of nothingness and where there also happens to be a space program. And the reason we originally went to Central Asia was to try to get access to Baikonur, which is the headquarters of the Russian space program. It's where they launch most of the rockets that go to the International Space Program. And then we started thinking about the location as a location for a thriller and how it had these sort of noir qualities. But I was still very attached to some of these megalomaniac ideas of Malevich. And in some ways, I feel like we could make the white-on-white title work. Part of that might be by putting in more texts that sort of more blatantly address the idea behind looking for perfection or something, or looking for this extreme place. And actually, Jeff Wood, the actor, wrote a very nice text that addresses that, and we haven't put it in the piece yet, but Kevin and I have been talking about it. So yeah, the title is sort of a good example of the confusion behind this piece, or it has a lot of history to it, and I guess for us in terms of the making of the piece, and so we haven't simplified the title. I guess also originally there was an idea just to make a locked movie, a feature film that would be called White on White, and would try to be kind of a noir-y thriller that would address some of the ideas of transcendence, but also power and how power plays out through controlling things like oil and water. So that's why you have references to these funny texts about water and about oil and about research. That doesn't really answer your question, but yeah, the title's long and confusing, and I'm torn about it, but I haven't figured out how to replace it or how to do something that addresses the piece better.
Just a quick follow-up. What about the algorithm? Like, how does it work? What is this? The word that we're looking
at? You want to talk about that? Just because you're so much better at talking about it than me.
I guess so. So ultimately, there are a few different sorts of algorithms, and an algorithm, of course, is just a set of rules that determines what happens after the other. And I don't know if we should really spell out precisely what those various algorithms are. I mean, there should be a little bit of, you know, man behind the curtain. But some of it is distinctly rule-based, and some of it is almost like we've written a kind of script. Especially during the vast majority of the time during the voiceovers, it's almost like the computer's playing from a musical score. And I guess we might as well... I mean, so we have thousands and thousands of clips.
We have about 2,500 in there.
Okay.
So there's yeah. It's not 10,000. I mean, it's 2,500. I would like it to be maybe 3,000. We're somewhere between 2 and 3.
Each of them are tagged with various phrases.
Metadata, yeah, they have tags like a photo in Flickr would have tags.
And they might be as banal as blue and green or they might be as interesting as
anxiety
suspicious.
Or I don't know. I guess we don't have pensive as a tag. We have sort of emotions as a tag. We have characters as tags. We have places. We have really obvious nouns: building, sky, you know, numbers.
And so all of the rules, whether it's our musical score during a voiceover, or whether it's in those places where the machine gets to branch out a little bit, are based on various ways of choosing clips based on those tags.
Yeah, what you see on orange there, since, I mean, we are showing that screen, and it's important to me that screen is in the room, that you know that it's not an edited movie, that it's a movie that will always render differently, and if you see it today and your friend sees it tomorrow, you don't see exactly the same thing. You will eventually start hearing the same voiceovers, you will see some of the same clips, but you'll never see them in exactly the same order, and you won't have the same experience. And but what you see in orange there is the tag that the computer's searching for. And if you read the screen more, you'll see the metadata, the tags that are attached to each visual. And, you know, I mean, Kevin said we don't have to show too much of the man behind the curtain, but I mean, I'll just say that the voiceovers have tags within their running time, which is why when you hear the phrase, "they grabbed him off the street," you will see something to do with him being grabbed off the street. And the mugging tag comes up. But then there's also much more abstract tags, and sometimes we've tagged things kind of antithetically, so you see the opposite of what's going on somehow. And sometimes the computer picks really well, and other times it picks badly, and other times we've tagged things not so well. You know, we keep seeing shots that come up that we, like, this is where we have this battle with the machine. You know, how much do we want to be editors? How much control do we want to have? And we made the algorithm, we had Jeff Garneau create the algorithm to cede control to the machine, and now, of course, we want to take back the control, and that tug of war is really interesting. So there was a question behind you, Noah. Maybe I should.
Mine is also a technical question about words. Are the voiceovers randomized as well, so that the voiceover can happen whatever order is generated by the computer, but within the voiceover there are connections?
Yeah, there's about 50 voiceover files, and yeah, the order they play in is random. And we've toyed with ideas of making that way more complicated, like making every sentence its own file, so that the stories would completely mix up. Like right now you hear these voiceovers that are a little bit of a continuous story, whether it's about a language ration or it's about being him grabbed off the street or it's about the kid. You hear a coherent little story, but I've been curious to see what happens if we would have it randomized sentence by sentence.
And then we've also talked about doing the opposite, about trying to make it more coherent. I mean, for instance, a simple way is for a screening like this, where we know a set duration, would be to set them up as being first third, middle, and last third, for instance.
Right.
Or to change the rules so that it does, at a certain point, hit an ending and write certain voiceovers that are clearly marked as ending or mark themselves as endings
right. In
their language.
Yeah, I mean, there would be, like, maybe if we... Because this is the second time we've done it as a theatrical experience, and it's really different than having it run in a gallery. We've done a couple work-in-progress gallery shows of it, and in a gallery, it feels so much more relaxed. A theatrical experience feels much more intense. But yeah, there has been a thought that, okay, well, if you do a theatrical experience, you pick your 50 favorite voiceovers, and then when it hits the 50th one, it goes to X, and X is the ending one, and you will always hear the ending one. But then that also takes the fun out of it. So I don't know. There's a lot of different options.
The fact that you're talking about an ending one, do you think of it as a story? Is there a debate amongst everybody who's involved about whether this is a narrative or completely...
Yeah, we do. We think of it... We would like that if you watched long enough, you would get some kind of a narrative. There isn't enough narrative really in there yet, I think, but I think maybe 6 months from now there might be. I think there will be a point with the piece that I bet if you got sat through an hour of it or an hour and a half, you'd walk away feeling like that you had absorbed some kind of a narrative.
I think I'm on the narrative. To me, the character development,
which Kevin just said we're cutting that name, by the way. She's like, where'd you get that name? I'm like, I don't know. It was in an old press release. Now he's like,
just the first name.
We've just decided to cut the first name. Yeah, he may have a different name.
Okay.
But yeah, our desire is that you come away, you have a feeling of being in a movie.
And that's obviously we all want it to be a narrative, you know, sort of our instinct to try to.
Of course. And I'm really interested in how we synthesize narrative, how we create narrative in our heads. I mean, in 89 Seconds, I was very interested in that too.
Can you give me an idea of just maybe with an example of how an algorithm handles the movement from one cut to another? Give me an example of a rule that we follow.
Sure. One of the rules that we've worked out, we've been calling the metonymy game, somewhat perversely maybe, and simply. If it reaches a point where it wants to play something new, but has no, otherwise has no instructions for what sort of thing to take next, to take a clip that has something in common with the previous.
Well, like in this clip, what you just saw, it would have game, window, Holt. Maybe it would have anxiety. It might have blue, red. I don't know. They're like the chess game clip you just saw. That's what it'd be the clips. And if it was playing that, at the end of that clip, when it hits the end of that duration of that clip, if it doesn't get a direction from the voiceover where to go next, it's going to pick the word blue and maybe look for a blue clip, or it's going to pick the word game and look for a game clip. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm getting it. So that every clip has embedded with it their keywords.
Yes,
exactly.
Who wrote the text? Who wrote the voiceovers?
The three of us, me and Kevin and Jeff Wood, we all just wrote bits, and we are still writing bits.
So do you have a framework of a narrative or interview?
Yeah, we keep debating the end, though, and Kevin's recent... not so much a climax, but we do have a framework of a narrative, a sort of silly noir narrative, and we haven't figured out how to end it. And that's part of the reason for having an endless movie.
The voiceovers are wonderful. The text is amazing.
That's
and
nice.
It does seem like it doesn't. You can't tell if it's a collaborative thing or if it was once or.
There was definitely an effort to keep a tone,
yeah,
and Kevin started writing voiceovers for this pretty recently, like in the last over the summer, I guess, and he really nailed the tone.
That's so great.
And it was great. Yeah. Behind Christina and one, two, I guess.
I was just considering, since you gave us a view into the mechanics of the algorithm, why have you considered any further readouts? Because I was surprised always, in the sense that you almost create your own internalized narrative. The screen always writes zero, pretty predominantly, I was trying to find like zero rejections, which to me after a while starts to undermine the algorithm process, because in some ways it seems so deliberate. And in some ways I became disconnected from that, because I figure in some ways if more traditional film, I'm always constantly considering the directorial process. And since I saw zero rejections, I started to discount this machine. But is that just a computer?
I'm not certain. I think I understand the question. I'm not certain what the zero rejections is reading as to you. How did...
I was interpreting that the film, it says it has 22 matches. So I'm imagining, after a while, we start to loop. And so I'm imagining what the 22 could have been.
Right.
And every time the computer says zero rejections, so I thought, maybe it's just telling me it has 22 videos, but it seems to be quite...
Zero rejections.
Never seems to have any doubt of what to play.
It does reject things. It also quite more, at least I notice it a lot, says things like... it looks for a specific clip and then says it can't find it. And that would be a rejection. Or it rejects things if it plays it, has played it somewhat recently, which we've tuned kind of lower than we
I think if the rejections is really just about you would feel more satisfied if it was saying 10 rejections or 20 rejections.
But,
is that what you're saying?
I mean, I would
I think if you watch longer, it'll start rejecting a lot of things. Oh. It's about the length of time we've run the algorithm.
But it sounds like your real question's about the desire for authorial control.
If one's going to have a simultaneous readout, it was more a question of how have you thought about elaboration of the readout as in relationship to the film. That's really what the question was.
We've thought about it, maybe not enough, but we've thought about it. I mean, we have a version that we aren't doing publicly yet that has a lot more readouts, which we thought for the public isn't that interesting. It's only interesting for us as the makers. But it tells us a lot. It tells us where we are in a music clip. It tells us exactly what's playing. And the only reason it's saying zero rejections is because right now we've told it, if you've played this clip, you can't play it again for another 20 clips. It has a max repeat of 20. But if we had a max repeat of 50, or a max repeat of 500 or something, we'd get the rejections would happen much more often. And I think it seems like you're saying that it just doesn't seem deliberate enough. But I think we've thought about it, maybe not as much as you would like, but we certainly thought about how it should look and what it should tell us. And to me, I've thought a lot about why it should be in the room. I feel like I want the audience to know that the edit's happening live and that it's happening live based on this algorithm. And there's a certain decision-making process we did as makers, and there's a certain decision-making process that's been taken away from us.
I have a friend who has read a book, 5.5 inches thick in pattern theory, and I'm probably getting into deep waters that I don't know anything about, but I was really curious when he said to me that there's a theory that actually there is no randomness in pattern, that eventually we will all get back to the pattern will start to develop if you go long enough with a 1 hour, right? Eventually you'll see some pattern start to develop. And I was wondering if there is a finite capacity to the algorithm, and if so, do you know what that is, or have you thought about tracking it and seeing how long it takes to get to that?
We haven't done the math. We could work with our programmer to do the math on that. I would guess it would be longer than the rest of our lifetime. I mean, just because. I mean, let's say you're talking about hour-long screenings, and how long would it take to have the same hour be precisely the same again? Might be death of the universe. I mean, it's
yeah, no, it's, oh, that's a really interesting question, though. Like, how long would it take for it to play exactly the same setup of clips within this, let's say, X number of minutes?
But how long would it take to start creating a recognizable pattern? I mean, that might be sort of right away because of how humans work.
Yeah, it's a really good question. It would be interesting. Yeah, it's sort of hard to get your head around, but yeah. I really like the question.
And just for documentation purposes, too, like it would just be a weird, satisfaction and obsession or something.
Right. I mean, it's true that, mathematicians talk about that there is no pure random, but part of what I like about this is, to me, it feels like life. In that you can do you can walk the same route every day on your way to work or whatever, and it's completely the same, and then it's, except that it's not, and it's completely different, and you're always going to pass different people on the street or look in a different direction or have a different sky, and it's also, most of it is kind of forgettable, like you, and then something happens that's absolutely not forgettable, and so there is a, to me, the pattern that I like is how it mimics life, in that there's some rules set down, and we follow the rules, but how those rules play out never repeat, at least, as Kevin's saying, in our lifetime, the exact same way. And it's really hard to recall. Like, I'm not going to be able to go home and remember this edit. I know it happened, but I'm every now and then I can remember certain juxtapositions that I think are really great. And that was originally why we built the algorithm. We thought, oh, let's build this machine to help us edit, like to give us more serendipity than we could ever have. Because I really think a lot of really interesting editing happens out of serendipity, and so I just wanted the serendipity machine. This machine to give me more chance and more luck than you can generate on your own. And And so I never thought of it actually as something for public consumption. I thought it's just a serendipity machine that we'll have in the studio and we'll use it to make the feature film. But then the serendipity machine kind of became, I felt like, its own artwork that could go out and have a life as well as a feature film that we still haven't cut. Whoa, a lot of questions. Terry, I guess.
To get to the storytelling a little bit, could you talk about, I apologize if Noah's question got into this, I stepped out for a second, but as I was sitting here watching, I was trying to remember and I was trying to get a glimpse of the code, and I felt slightly overwhelmed, like, my head can't do this, you know, I can't read and look at the same time, I can't move my eye from that to that, stay completely in tune with everything. And it made me think, that's what's happening to him, the Mr. Holtz.
Oh, that's nice. I like that idea.
Was that a part of any kind of conscious decision?
That he's completely overwhelmed?
Yes, and that he's experiencing something so overwhelming in his life that really, to me, was mimicking what I saw.
I wish he was here to talk about it. he would love the question. I would probably say yes, that's what's happening to him. I think he felt pretty overwhelmed by the character and the experience of trying to be the character. And we have talked a lot about that he's, in our mind, in our narrative that isn't quite developed, he's a geophysicist code writer who's supposed to be writing algorithms for maybe the oil business, maybe some other mineral business, maybe for searching for lithium or for water. And these geophysicists use these algorithms to map underground and make predictions about what is there. And so he's supposedly working on some code, and we're also working on some code that's trying to control the movie, as he's trying to sort of help control these business endeavors of these people that have coerced him into working. And so, yeah, like, there is an idea that we're a little overwhelmed and we're trying to create this machine that's running the movie, and the characters are sort of trying to control each other or control him.
And in what we saw today, there were at least one or two voiceovers that hint towards that pretty explicitly. There's the, as he wanders around, he gets lost, he finds himself in different terrains. And we've been talking about more and more making that connection explicit.
Right, right. Yeah, it's hard because, like, when you work on sort of regular, you know, mainstream, I guess, feature films, you always feel like spelling things out seems so stupid. Like, but with this kind of an idea, actually, the more you spell things out, it actually works better. There was two questions behind you, the yellow, and then the guy behind.
I just had a question about the way that people are dressed, sort of like almost old, like 70s almost, but then it's supposed to be almost sort of futuristic. And there's times when it seems like it's in the 70s almost, but then times when you can see things that make it just look like it is maybe the future. But then other times where it's seems just like now, and I didn't know if any of that was just sort of to add to the confusion, or if there was any purpose in how that
was. There was definitely an idea that we should make the character look like he was in 1973, but, you know, we shot this footage over 2 years, and the character was developed as we were on the road, and so you see the character change from being kind of a backpacking kind of, you know, beatnik traveler to being the character with the mustache and the trench coat and the briefcases and the dorky glasses. But certainly the idea that it looks a little like 1973 sometimes, but it's also the future, but the future is like 3 or 4 years from now. It was kind of something we wanted to play with. And then there's footage that, you know, just looks very recognizable as everyday contemporary life. And so in a way, trying to conflate these ideas of a future world from these various locations, because there are these quite futuristic cities we shot in, with a lot of Norman Foster architecture, which is this really kind of kitschy sci-fi architecture that is really in fashion in new rich Asian countries and in Dubai. And so, you know, we wanted to conflate, yeah, that the architecture, those certain periods of history where, like, you know, whether you say 70s or whether you say right now or you say, 10 years from now, where there's this idea of making this sort of perfect future world that doesn't really exist, and it should be this kind of mixed up chronology and mixed up time. But yeah, there was definitely an effort to make at least the final shooting look as kind of 70s as possible.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear more about some of the locations that you filmed in. And the footage is incredible. And these sort of like buildings, like you talk a little bit about like the brutalist buildings, but I'm interested to hear about the locations, like that building with the giant satellite dish on top of it. Was some of the stuff you, did you particularly set out to film some of these locations?
I mean, we particularly set out to do nothing at all, you know. Our original goal really was to try to get into Baikonur, and Baikonur is the Russian space program. It happens to be in the middle of the Kazakh desert. It's sort of like going, trying to get, I mean, you can't get in there. It's a military base. We got taken out of the police station and kicked out at 2 in the morning and told not to come back. And we were very lucky that they kicked us out because they could have decided not to let us go. I became really interested in sort of the conflation of communism and capitalism and the idea of, that the Soviets were building what they thought was this sort of perfect future world utopia. And now with these like new rich Norman Foster buildings, they're trying to build this perfect future world utopia. And the conflation of those two things is so ironic. The irony is so deep, you know. So at least the generation I grew up, you were really taught never the twain will meet, you know. And now these, at least the signifiers of those regimes have been glued together. You know, those brutalist Khrushchevoi, which are the Soviet apartment buildings that were those prefab buildings built everywhere in the Soviet Union, which are quite functional. You know, they look so like sort of brutalist and depressing or whatever, but actually we've lived in a lot of them now, and they're really functional. Now what they do is they sheathe them all with brass and gold and mirrored glass and as much chrome as possible. So the facades, once the street-facing side will look like Las Vegas or Dubai or whatever. It'll look super kitschy, but then the behind is the old Soviet architecture. You know, where you'll have cities where it's surrounded with those buildings and just the central plaza is this crazy, glittering thing, you know, which is like the big egg thing you saw, the big glass egg with the elevator is a monument that happens to be in one of the capital cities in Central Asia we were in. I'm trying really hard not to say exactly where we were shooting. I mean, I'm not trying to be cagey, but and like in some ways when I'm face to face with people, I don't mind saying, well, we shot mainly in Kazakhstan, but we also shot in Dubai, we also shot in Azerbaijan. You know, I shot a little bit now in New York. I mean, and there may be other locations as well. But like the place, in a way, to me, is not so important. It's like people had their very nationalistic ideas where we were shooting, that we were representing their place. And the place is imaginary, the place is a fantasy city, and it's a conflation of these places that represent some idea about this beautiful future, which White on White was sort of about that. Yeah, in the back. Middle, you're the middle.
I have a couple of comments. A couple of loops have repeated since you've turned the sound down.
A couple of the stories.
A couple of the voiceover kind of thing.
Right.
Richard Arden, and that's been interesting to see sort of.
To see a different edit of that. That can be quite magical, yeah.
But I was wondering, did you write the code from scratch? Because it looks kind of like some aspects of Super Collider, which is a music kind of thing, but it's different.
You know how much different from scratch?
No, it counts as from scratch. I mean,
it uses
libraries for video playback. And,
And
I don't know the underworkings, but
yeah. I mean, Jeff Garneau, the kid who wrote the code, you know, 22-year-old grad student. He wrote it more or less from scratch. You know, we started talking when we started working on it. I said, "Oh, is it better to use like Max or Jitter or some of that stuff?" And he decided, "No, it was better to write it from scratch." And it has been made it
be
that.
Interesting to do this with.
What'd you say?
Jitter wouldn't be interesting to do this with.
I mean, most of the work here is database calls and.
It just means also that because he's written it from scratch, every time Kevin and I have ideas that we want to see changed, we can ask him to sort of write that in. And so he has been able to make it more and more interesting and complex.
Yeah, it seems like it works really interesting.
And this is not the most current version of it. Like I say, there is a version in the studio where we can, you know, play it out to five different screens and play it and move the screens all around the room. And, you know, I mean, if we had three computers, we could move the screens wherever we want. We could make the screens any size we want. And it shows us other data. Like, because we thought about a two-screen version of this. We've thought about a four- or five-screen version. But so far, for me, it's more interesting if it feels kind of like a movie. That's always the question I have for the audience. Does it feel like a movie? Is that yes or no?
Yes.
You're in the blue.
Better than the movie.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah. Can you talk about Yuri's office at the Contemporary and its inclusion in the film?
Well, it's in the film, and that's not it. It's in the film as of about 3 days ago. Kevin and I picked some. I shot footage about a month and a half ago with Jeff Wood, the main actor, and with a young Russian girl who's not really an actress, but did pretty well. And we sort of hurriedly tried to get some of that material in there. So the room you see with the globe and the two telephones and where he's sitting around with the tape deck, the little reel-to-reel player, that's Yuri's office. And it is a room that is now going to open as an exhibition on Saturday. And it was created from a photograph I made in the reel opposite of Yuri Gagarin in Star City, outside of Moscow. And that room has been locked down as a museum piece, as it's kept the same since the day he died. I think he died in 64. I could be wrong about that. He was an astronaut. He was also a cosmonaut. He was also a test pilot. And he died in a test flight. And I felt that room had a really sort of, for me, almost a religious feeling. I mean, it was so interesting to, when I first started going to the ex-Soviet Union, and where you remove religion and then you replace religion with these other icons that have a religious feeling. The most obvious example of that is Lenin's tomb. But Yuri's office to me also had that feeling. It felt like a religious place. And in some ways, there were just little signifiers that made it special, but otherwise I felt like, oh, it could be the office of an accountant or a lawyer or a civil servant, but he had two telephones, and one was black and one was green. And the globe wasn't the Earth, the globe was Mars. And there was a sculpture of a rocket on his desk, but other than that, it was a very kind of mundane place. It was sort of a banal place. And the banality of it, I thought, was really interesting. Like, I'm really quite excited by how, from these banal experiences or these banal places, these really extreme things happen. And in some ways, to me, I think suprematism, white on white, has to do with that. That's a more complicated conversation. But does that begin to answer your question?
Yeah, was it a place that you discovered during the filming? Actually, before,
right before we went, we tried to go to Baikonur. We went. The impetus for the piece kind of came out of a joke. A friend said, "Oh, what's the third painting?" Meaning, he thought I had made two works about painting, and I should make another piece that had to do with painting. And I said to my friend, "Oh, that's crazy. I'm not interested in making work about painting." And he said, "You have to." And I said, "I don't have to." And he said, "Yes, you do." And I very sarcastically said, "Okay, white on white by Malevich." And then we started thinking about it, and Jeff and I especially started joking, and Jeff kept joking that, or not joking, he was quite serious. He wanted to go to space. He wanted to be one of these space tourists. You know, he even wrote to Charles Simonyi, who was one of the guys who went recently to the ISS. But he doesn't have $30 million, so he's not going to space. But when we started thinking about the Malevich painting and then his desire to go to space, I thought there were some really interesting, funny, and poetic connections. Hence, we started doing this, looking around at, you know, the space programs, and the Russian space program is really interesting. And you could sort of say from that office, you know, the Russian-American space race started. You know, they got the first man into space, and that and Sputnik really started the space race. And that desire for sort of that extreme place was really interesting to me, and that it came from this, in a way, this room, where not only this room, but partly from that office.
The narratives being in different languages, it kind of, for me anyways, contributed to this being in a nameless place, adding another layer of mystery. And I was wondering what your objectives were in having these different narratives being in different languages.
Yeah, it's Russian and English, and now you hear more in English. It used to be. Initially, when I started, there was more in Russian. The objective was partly, to give it that sort of feeling of the mystery, and that I knew most of my audience would not be Russian speaking. But I was also shooting in countries where that was the predominant language. I mean, even if it's not the native language, like in Central Asia, it's the language of business. It's the language, it's the sort of lingua franca that everybody, it's complicated, but it's the language you have to speak if you want to get around. And so I was, I thought that I wanted to address that in some way. But I also wanted to give it this foreignness. You know, you have this character who's a foreigner and he's in a place where maybe he's being watched, or maybe he's just thinking that, or maybe he's not, but there's a bunch of stuff he doesn't understand. And so, and originally the idea was that you would hear the narrative through conversations, like telephone conversations, and through one narrator, the telephone conversations would be in English, and the narrator would be sort of giving you more of this philosophical text or meta-text or background stories, and that would all be in Russian. And that's become more confused now, but it was definitely that I always thought from the beginning the narrative should be in Russian and English, partly just to pay homage to where I was shooting, and partly because I felt that fit with this character being in a place where he doesn't know what's happening around him.
Russia for 2.5 years?
No. I wasn't really much. We were in Russia a few times, but only briefly. Mainly we were in Central Asia. And over 2 years, we went 4 times. So each time we spent about a month, or sometimes maybe the longest was 5 or 6 weeks. But this, over the span of those 2 years, there were these different trips.
How long approximately were each one of your trips?
4 to 6 weeks.
So did you have any knowledge of Russian going over there?
No. Catherine, our production manager, is getting pretty good at her Russian. but I don't speak any Russian. And when we first went, the first two trips, we didn't even go with anybody who spoke Russian. We just decided we'd figure it out.
It sounds like you guys just wanted to kind of go to some place. You were interested in space program and stuff, but you just kind of wanted to backpack someplace that you've never been before, and I'm sure that not knowing Russian, it was very confusing, probably especially the first time, all the times you were there, a lot of times it's not like just walking around in America here, and I think it translates through the film, watching it, and obviously there's never going to be a concrete narrative. It sounds like, in a way, you guys never really had a set plan to go.
We didn't. In the beginning, we didn't. We just had this plan to make something that... There was a plan to try to understand... For me, there was a plan to try to understand the desire to go to space and the desire for this sort of nothingness, this emptiness, which had to do with this painting and had to do with this desire of my main actor who really wanted to go to space, or just people who just want to do that. And so that was sort of the plan. But it doesn't mean that there will never be a narrative, because each time we went, our idea of a sort of thriller story was furthered by our travels. And now in the studio, we're still trying to push the story along. So I feel like, we certainly went without a narrative and even without a character. And as each time that developed, and that's still developing.
Yeah, well, I think it creates a zeitgeist for sure, and everyone walks away with their own narrative because, it's a logarithm creating it, so, everyone's going to pull their own thing from it, so that's where it's,
I like the idea that everyone pulls their own thing from it. I'm quite interested in trying to make things where that's possible.
But it definitely sets a zeitgeist of, this desolate, lonely kind of landscape. And your main character, he's talking about capital A, is that it?
City A.
City A. And
you know, it seems like he's trying to achieve something, something, there's some kind of thing he's trying to achieve or get to, but that's kind of the underlying mystery throughout the whole thing, and that, I guess, you know, what I'm pulling from it was almost, I mean, they were talking about, I guess if you could go into maybe more about how did you get to the point about like speech and vocabulary, like how you guys were talking about how everyone had a set amount of vocabulary, and that if it wasn't used properly from the onset, that you could become, you know, almost just dumbed down.
You're saying, why is that in there?
Well, I'm trying to figure out, you know, maybe, you know, that's part of the beauty is everyone pulls their own thing from it, but, you know, I guess in a way I'm trying to figure out, you know, my narrative, there's little pieces I'm picking up.
Yeah, that is kind of the point,
maybe
though.
That's the thing, is that you guys never really had a set narrative, I guess, right.
But just to jump in a touch on that, they actually had, there are a lot of narrative elements that they actually had sort of hammered down or nailed down, but then that have gotten pared out and that have become more ambiguous. I mean, it's been working in both directions. I mean, especially the actor who plays Holtz has reams of backstory, it seems. I mean, that Jeff has written, that Jeff has thought through.
Yeah.
But I think that's precisely what's being toyed with here. I mean, some of the voiceovers clearly undermine each other, at least to a certain extent. And I think that's part of the play that's going on.
And Kevin's sort of suggesting undermining them more, like that we would have three different voiceovers that would each start out in the end, and they would have conflicting endings. But you may read two or three of them in the course of an hour and have to decide which one you want to believe.
I was just going to say that, and it's sort of the answer to the thing about the second movie, that it kind of feels to me like a choose-your-own-adventure novel in a movie form. So
yeah, people always talk about those.
I build my own story, and I think that in the end thing, it totally builds on that even more.
Well, That's good. I mean, I think that to take what you just said further, it's a choose-your-own-adventure book that you're just reading in order, in page number order, instead of actually following the rules, right?
I've never seen those books. You're seeing every single
alternative.
Right, you're just sort of seeing what all the alternatives are, and then going back and choosing a different, you know, you say, get killed by a tiger, whatever, you go back and try to change what you try to do the stories.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, it gets the aleatoric structure of the work. You've got to admit that there's no such thing as an innocent cinematic eye. Okay? So you've got this created with, I think you said, 2,500 clips.
Video clips.
I mean, that in itself is mind-boggling, because 2,500 factorial is an enormous number, so that's...
I don't know if I think it's such a big number in the course of like a feature film. How many clips do you think?
2,500
factorial. Right. Okay.
2,500 times 2,499 times 24.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. What I'm wondering as I'm looking at it, because I'm getting a very particular sense of filmic genre. Yeah. I'm thinking along the lines of a spectrum from Ziga Vertov to Tarkovsky. Everything else in between. What were the kinds of cinematic influences and visual languages that were part of your kind of makeup as you were doing these clips? Were you thinking about framing things in particular ways?
Yeah. Well, certainly the more produced stuff. I mean, there's stuff in there that was clearly kind of, you know, hippie road footage, and then there's stuff that's, you know, more produced people, you know, people actually trying to shoot something that looks a little like a movie. And so in terms of the influences, though, I mean, some of them are pretty obvious. Like you just said, Tarkovsky, obviously. I mean, it's called City A. That's a nod to Alphaville. It's also happens to be that a lot of the places we were shooting started with the letter A. And, you know, so Chris Marker, I mean, but
certainly when we first started going to these locations, Angelo, one of the people I was shooting with, said, you could just reshoot Alphaville here. You don't have to do anything. And the beauty of a movie like that is it's supposed to be the future, and it's just a guy walking around Paris in the 60s. You know, they haven't built anything. And in places like this, it also wasn't necessary to build anything. So, I mean, you kind of, I think you kind of got the references pretty clearly already. Should we wrap it up? One more person. Okay, one, two, three, then we'll wrap it up.
One more sort of technical question. I really love the audio, the music, sound, whatever you call it. But it also seemed to go, was it embedded with, I mean, some of the audio was embedded in the video clips, obviously, because, you know, the clips match the talk. But then there was added sound, and I'm wondering if those were attached to something, or how those came to the picture.
There is obviously some sync sound on the video. It's pretty clear when that happens. There is, with the narrations, with the voiceovers, there is sound mixed, there is some music and sound mixed with those. And then in between those, it's picking